Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. Conspiracy theories are nothing new. In fact, they're as old as civilization itself. Persistent conspiracies about a new world order or the work of non-governmental groups like the Trilateral Commission in the 1970s have persisted for decades. More recently, traumatic events like the attacks of September 11, 2001, the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and the Boston Marathon bombing have spawned countless conspiracy theories, often under the banner of truthers who deny and protest the official narrative of these events, many of which played out in the public eye and on camera. It's clear that the advent of the internet and its ability to connect like-minded individuals from across the globe has turbocharged the conspiracy game. Conspiracy websites, many posing as news outlets, as well as online discussion forums like Reddit and 4chan, spawn and nurture conspiracies amongst those who are drawn to them. Social networks like Twitter and Facebook provide a medium to blast those theories out to an audience of hundreds of millions, often in a format that's indistinguishable from factual news. But is all this just random energy, or is there a structure and purpose to the online rumor and conspiracy game? Those are the kinds of questions our guest this week, researcher Kate Starbird, concerns herself with. An assistant professor in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering at the University of Washington, Starbird specializes in an area called crisis informatics, which looks at the use of social media during crisis events. But in recent months, she's narrowed her focus to what used to be a peripheral phenomena, online rumoring during crisis events like the Boston Marathon bombing. In this interview with the Security Ledger, she talks about observing the growth of online rumoring, conspiracy theories, and disinformation campaigns as a byproduct of her research on online responses to crisis events. I started by asking Kate to talk about how she went from studying online responses to real-world crises to focusing on conspiracy theories that propose the notion that the crisis itself was a hoax.
Over the last 3 or 4 years, we started seeing a certain kind of rumor, which was what we initially saw was a conspiracy theory rumor that said that, especially for the man-made events, that they weren't happening, or they weren't happening in the way that the mainstream media was telling the story. So for the Boston Marathon bombings, there was this claim that bombings were perpetrated by the Navy SEALs, that they weren't perpetrated by the suspects, but instead that they were perpetrated by the Navy SEALs. And these people, some of them still contend that this alternative narrative of the story is true. So we saw that in the Boston Marathon bombings, but then we saw it in other events as well. We saw that after the Umpqua school shootings, people were saying that they were staged event, a hoax event, that they were staged by crisis actors. So they weren't real victims. These were fake events, hoax events, perpetrated by someone, probably the government, in their minds with the goal of motivating gun control laws. So we saw that after Umpqua. We also saw similar things after the Paris attacks. It said, no, these weren't perpetrated by those attackers. They didn't really happen, whatever. So we saw the same rumor happening, and they're not all exactly the same one. Each event is different, and they shift the narrative around a little bit to fit the event, and then they find evidence out there in the world that they think fits the event. There's a common set of people who are talking about these things, and also some people come to the conversation for one event one theory and not another, right? So I'm not saying that the same group of people believe all of them, but there seem to be common people and common elements across all of these different kinds of events and when what we're calling alternative narratives of those events, which contend that the mainstream narrative is false.
Right.
That's their contention.
How exactly do you measure rumors? Kind of how do you collect this information and then how do you quantify it?
Yeah, so these are great questions. We've done a lot of Twitter-first research because Twitter data is public. Almost all of it is shared by public accounts, and then people are allowed to collect that. Anyone can collect it, but as researchers, I can write a program that taps into the Twitter API. They allow us to do that, and we can collect Twitter data in real time. And so Twitter becomes a nice, like, initial source for studying a lot of these phenomena. But we also take other content within the tweets and look out into the broader information space. So what I'll do is I'll take a collection of tweets, and then I'll take all the links within those tweets, and then we'll go trace those out to different web domains or websites and look at the content there. I also have some students now moving into other spaces, looking at, we're actually studying Snapchat, not for rumoring, but in the context of crisis events, and Reddit. We're looking at rumoring and online sense making during crisis events on Reddit as well. So we're looking at other platforms, but we have had a big focus on Twitter due to the public availability of those tweets. And also there's an interesting intersection of like the production of news that's happening on Twitter and the ecosystem around the propagation of like information and misinformation with automated accounts and bots, right? So there's a lot of interesting phenomena happening there that make it a really interesting platform to study.
How do you determine what is a rumor and what is what is a rumor or an alternative narrative that's being fronted? I mean, is it a matter of looking for certain keywords that come to characterize the often referred to as kind of the truthers, or is it more subtle than that, using machine learning or what have you to separate out the people reflecting on or commenting on the actual news versus people who are going down this alternative narrative?
So let me step back. It's actually one of the hardest questions for our research was to figure out what was a rumor and what is not a rumor. But in crisis events, information is moving really, really fast, and people are trying to make sense of it. During crisis events, one of the long-term characteristics of those is that rumors happen because the information isn't perfect. It's changing. It's dynamic over time. The best information 5 minutes ago is probably not as good as the best information right now. So the story actually is changing. So we actually look at rumor more generally as sort of informal information at the time. It can turn out to be true. It can turn out to be false. But the truth is not yet known. And there's different kinds of rumors. There's three kind of salient types that we've seen. And one is sort of this clearly fake internet meme type rumor where someone's just trying to get attention for their account. And an example of this, of someone spreading a photo of a little girl running a 5K race, and it said this girl had died during the Boston Marathon bombings while running it, and this was a picture of her. And of course, this wasn't true. The girl didn't die, and little girls don't run marathons. That spread. We have 90,000 tweets and retweets of this very silly kind of internet rumor. But those are easily spotted, and you can tell that they're false. There's also sort of this sense-making rumor where things are changing over time, and people are just trying to come up with a theory of what's going on during an event, and it's with good intentions. And so the majority of our rumors are actually of that type. And then there was this other type that we just kept seeing, which was these weird things about crisis actors and hoax and something else. And so over time and across events, we started to notice certain keywords that went with that kind of conspiracy theory, alternative narrative, rumor. And so it became one of the three rumor types that we were studying, and it had a sort of language around it that, I mean, I've mentioned it here. The language around it was, crisis actors, false flag, and hoax, as well as a couple other terms. And if we search for those terms, we could often surface rumors related to that almost for any man-made event once we realized those terms were there. And we did the searching both with computational tools, like you would do, go do these massive searches. But again, we did a lot of the work through grounded methods as well, where we're using just many, many, like crowdsourcing. I used 10 students looking at hundreds and hundreds of tweets each to kind of identify what these rumors were.
Are there differences? I mean, you mentioned using, looking at Twitter and then Reddit and other forums. I mean, are there substantive differences between both the players and then also the way that these rumors are spread and promulgated on these platforms? Or is it pretty much the same content just repurposed for different social media?
We've still got a long way to go in terms of understanding who is purposely spreading this kind of rumor or not. And I haven't done comparative studies with this kind of rumor compared to Reddit and Twitter. I will say that the affordances of the different platforms do shape different conversations and how and where they happen. And I think on Reddit, there are whole subreddits devoted to these kinds of conspiracy theories. And in those places, those people are talking about it, and other people just don't go there. Whereas on Twitter, these ideas are being shared, and sometimes they're reaching new people who are not seeking them out, right? So Twitter might be a place where it's more likely that an infection happens. But right now, for me, that's just speculation, right? So we would have to really go look at those kinds of things.
You commented that there were sort of signatures for these various rumor types, and you noticed that the signature for some of these kind of truther rumors was very different than other types of rumors, that they're more enduring and that they seem linked to very frequently back to political themes. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. We had these three different types, and then the alternative narrative rumors, they just look different on a lot of different dimensions. So when I say a signature, what I mean is different kinds of dimensions about how a rumor spreads. And one aspect is like just the volume over time. And for a typical rumor, we saw there'd be just a really quick spike, and then it'd be a fast sort of exponential decay where kind of looks like a long tail curve with a really high spike. With these conspiracy theory rumors, they didn't spike as high. It took them a while to grow. There was some conversation as they were sort of building to kind of a tension around them. And then once they built, they didn't go away. They kind of went away for a little bit, and then they'd spike back up again. They'd go away for a little bit, spike back up again. And they persisted over time. Most of our crisis-related rumors would die out within a few hours or a few days. Once the truth became known, they were debunked and it went away. For these, there was no debunking them, right? Like, people would come and try to debunk them, but they would just counter that evidence or somehow come up with a new explanation. In fact, we saw that with the Navy SEALs rumor. It was pretty soon they decided that it wasn't the Navy SEALs. No, it was mercenaries from Blackwater. And so they evolved it as the information came, but the narrative itself about what the rumor was never went away. And so these things looked really different. And then another thing that we noticed was that these conspiracy theory rumors were citing a bunch of external websites, a lot of different websites. Over the last few months, it's become clear that that is really important, what's going on in those spaces.
Right.
And so these observations that we had about, okay, wait a minute, the tweets that were related to those conspiracy theories, those signatures, they look different in these weird ways. And we went back and looked, wait a minute, those are bots in there, you know? And then, wait a minute, there's all those sites. What are those sites about? And so in the December, January of this year, I went back and I was like, let me go unpack what was going on in some of those conspiracy theories and unpack what these bots are and unpack what those sites are and what they mean. What are the websites that are cited as people are creating these conspiracy theories? When I went into there, I found things that totally surprised me, and I had no idea that that was what was happening in and around these conspiracy theories that we've been seeing for years.
For example?
I knew that these spaces were politicized, so I go in and start, you know, intensely reading all these websites that are cited in the construction of conspiracy theories, and the U.S. right-left political spectrum completely collapses. It doesn't work anymore. And what was salient was not the kinds of issues that I've always kind of grown up thinking about or thinking that politics cared about. What was salient was this term that kept coming up that I had never really seen in this way. Maybe I've seen it but not noticed it, but globalist, globalism, anti-globalist, anti-globalism. Almost all of these sites were promoting this anti-globalist notion, and yet the sites themselves could be sort of what I would say is right-leaning or left-leaning. What they meant by globalist was different. For some, globalism means free trade. For others, globalism means immigration, open borders. And so anti-globalism means, you know, anti-immigration, anti-free trade, a lot of different anti-things. But a lot of these sites were identifying themselves as anti-globalist. And then the flip side of anti-globalist is nationalist. And some sites spelled that out, others didn't. But what they were doing was they were supporting a nationalist worldview. And not just nationalists in the U.S., because a lot of these sites were not U.S.-based. There were nationalist sites that were Russian-Ukrainian-based. In this construction of conspiracy theories, these sites are all cited in this development of an ideology that is very anti-government. They're anti-Western government impact in the world.
I mean, we've seen reports that governments like Russia operate more or less 24/7 alternative news, alternative information units that just kind of do this via website comments and Twitter feeds. It's also been reported that there is a substantial use of bots or automated Twitter accounts to disseminate this information, kind of give it oomph out there on the social network. How big a role does just that type of astroturfing play in getting this message amplified from maybe a few fringe actors to, you know, basically everybody's Twitter feed in one way or another?
I don't know. And I think that's what we need to be figuring out. That's on our list of things to be researching. And when I say we, that's not me and my group. I think that's researchers, journalists, anybody who cares. I think we need to be trying to answer that question. Is what is the impact, and who's doing the orchestrating and what's happening? I can say that I found evidence of bots. We have bots in that data, a lot of bots. In fact, that's one of the reasons we initially started looking at it, again, was the bots were so interesting. Let's go look at the bots. We have bots in that data. There's a huge, many of the sites that we saw were very strongly pro-Russian. We had Sputnik News and RT are both in the network graph. they didn't propagate these particular conspiracy theories, but they were cited by people who were propagating these conspiracy theories. And so they're integrated and they get graphed in a similar way to why Washington Post and New York Times are in there. But we can see, so the people that are spreading these theories are going to those sites as well. We also had a site called Katehon, K-A-T-E-H-O-N, which seemed to be a think tank, a Russian-Ukrainian think tank in the web graph. I imagine if I used, and we're going to do this in the summer, we're going to go do a much broader set of terms and look more broadly at the ecosystem, not just those particular conspiracy theories. I have a feeling that those sites are going to be more prominent. There's going to be more of them. And I don't know how many of the other sites, we don't know who owns them and who runs them and how they're run. But I did find evidence of a lot of the same content and authors being posted across these different sites. And so there's a strong possibility that a single entity or a small group of entities is running a much larger set of websites. Possible that the content is being coordinated. So it looks like it's an ecosystem. It looks like you're going to get information from different sites. But in reality, that information is coming from the same set of sources.
You often talk about these rumors with terms like half-life and decay rate, sort of these terms that I think about in terms of like radioactive elements. I mean, are there analogs there? And do these rumors eventually lose their radioactive charge and just, you know, become inert or not?
We often use the viral or like epidemic disease metaphor for rumors with infection and spread, but that doesn't always match up either. For conspiracy theory rumors or the alternative narrative rumors we've been looking at, I'm not sure that either of those metaphors is necessarily going to hold. I mean, but I've got to think more about the radioactive one because yeah. There is something about being exposed and developing a worldview or a set of sort of heuristics where these start to seem more and more reasonable to you.
Right.
And I know that just from watching, from interacting with some of the folks in this data and from reading the data, and then also, you know, I've actually had some conversations in the last few weeks after publishing the blog with people that are really informative. I'm really interested and I'm really empathetic. Having spent 2 weeks in that ecosystem, it is very confusing. It is very easy to start seeing why people might come to believe these things due to how the information is being accessed and what information they're seeing and how, right? And so I think we do need some other metaphor besides the viral spread one, the epidemic one, because this is something that's very different.
Conspiracy theories obviously are nothing new. They've been around for thousands of years. And obviously disinformation campaigns themselves are not new. Is there anything new here, or is this really just a matter of technology juicing two very human phenomena that have been around for a long time?
The ability of technology to catalyze some of these things and the way we receive our information, I think we've become more vulnerable, or we've always been vulnerable, and these are highlighting our vulnerability.
Yeah.
Yes, these things have always happened, but technology is making more and more vulnerable.
I was going to say, I mean, the other interesting thing is that these rumors, because they're consumed online and often very far from where these incidents happen, there is no connection that people have to them. They exist purely in the realm of abstraction. And there's actually a really interesting YouTube video that's kind of funny but also sad about a guy in Cambridge confronting an InfoWars reporter.
Yeah.
I don't know, you've probably seen that one, kind of in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, and really calling him out, and he's taping it with his cell phone while he does it, and just basically saying, you know, you guys said the FBI did the Boston Marathon, you said it was a false flag report, and just kind of saying, you son of a bitch, how dare you? And confronting him in like a really human way as a member of the Boston community who is personally, you know, all of us were personally affected by that, and the InfoWars reporter skulked. But it struck me that it's easy to entertain these things in the absence of any human connection to them, when they're just operate at the level of abstraction, and either it supports your worldview or it doesn't, and that's the only thing you need to consider.
Yeah, one of the points I was going to make, and then another one that I wasn't, and I think they go really well together, and one of them is the distance. So The difference is that we're accessing these from very far away. Historically, you'd be experiencing these kinds of data flows within like your community, within people that you knew and in places that you knew, and you would have, you know, you knew someone who saw the victims. So it would be preposterous to say that it didn't happen, or you knew the person's wife or parent or whatever, right? So, but here we have this great distance where the ideas can be injected from all over the world, and people are so far away from it that why would they believe the parent of the child more than the InfoWars reporter? Because they're just as distant and they seem just as credible because there's no connection to locality. And so this difference of getting our news from afar versus getting our news from the local paper is really fascinating. And then on top of it is something we've always known about the internet is there's no human-to-human contact. And that changes some of the social contract that we have. Some of the ways that we behave socially, we will do things to people online that we would never do to them in person. And so the combination of those things, I think you're right. I think it enables this kind of these alternative narratives, which can I mean they're just for people that experience these tragedies in their communities. The fact that other people are denying them these tragedies is disgusting. Like it really gets to, you know, it's just a horrific kind of thing. And yet people are able to do that because we've got this great distance. We don't actually know or see the people. And it seems just as reasonable because the information is all mediated from these great social and geographic distances.
Are we going to find a way to put fake news and rumors and untruths sort of in their box and clean up the, you know, information stream so that it is reflective of things that are actually happening in the world? So is there a way to do that? And I know Facebook and a whole bunch of other companies are thinking very hard, Twitter are thinking very hard about questions like that. Do you think it's something that's even possible, or is that ship sailed?
Yeah, the rumoring that I've studied in the past during crisis events, a lot of that, not only can you not stop it, maybe you can, but it's part of the like collective sense-making process that happens. It serves like a psychological benefit of people that are trying to make sense of what's going on. Sometimes right. They get the wrong explanation. Sometimes they get the right explanation. So when I think about that, I'm not sure that designing to stop that kind of rumoring is the right thing to do. Maybe to design platforms that help the truth emerge through that process, I think is a better goal than like stopping rumors. Similarly, when we look at sort of the intentional fake news, conspiracy theories, and other kinds of things, I don't think computer or a crowd or a person at the backside identifying fake news and pulling it out of the stream is necessarily going to be the thing that works. I think it's a more complex solution that's going to have to happen, and it's not going to be as easy as just removing content. I don't think in the American public here that we're going to be comfortable with the idea that someone's automatically or otherwise filtering the content. I think Facebook has already faced that when they tried to react to fake news with a lot of pushback about how they were filtering and whom they were filtering. So the solution is something tricky that relates to, you know, surfacing the credibility, allowing information to flow, but surfacing credibility. Mm-hmm. Some sort of education, like having people become aware. I mean, that's what I wrote the blog for. Having people become aware of what's going on.
Literacy, right.
Yeah, it's a literacy. Yeah, it's this new media literacy, although even that's in the blog I talk about how that language has been co-opted by the folks doing this. But I think there is something about literacy. And it's not literacy. We think about literacy. Oh, K-12. But this is K-99. Like, we all need it. This needs to happen across every age group. We're not going to just go into the middle schools or the high schools or even the undergraduate classes and fix this problem, because it's with all of us. And in fact, I think the younger generations are going to be better at dealing with this than the rest of us, because the rules we learned about how to interpret information don't work in this information space very well. So it's both education and I think it's education and design. And I've been saying this in some of the comments of my blogs. I really think it's an all hands on deck. Mm-hmm. I think everybody can contribute in some way. As a researcher, I'm going to go do research, but I think technology designers can help. Everyday people can help. Teachers can help. journalists can have.
It's kind of a public health problem in some ways. I mean, I think that's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
I agree. I do think it is. I think it absolutely. I think that's a great way to frame it.
Now that you have gone on Medium in a public way, and do you worry that you, Kate Starbird, become a part of this tapestry of pro and anti-conspiracy figures whose names get bandied about and links shared and so on? Is that something you've experienced since going on Medium, or is it something you're concerned about?
The answer to all of that is yes. I will say that I did this intentionally and with enough knowledge of what could happen to at least know what I was getting myself into. And I thought about the consequences. I thought about the consequences before I submitted the paper. And then when I decided to put a Medium post out, like, that's very different than sending it to an academic community. This is something I feel like the public needs to know. And I actually spent a good deal of time. I took the day off and I wrote the Medium post. And then I took my 2 days of my spring break and wrote the Medium post, right? And I devoted a very set amount of time to this. I thought, I want this to be communicated to the public. I think it's really important for the public to know this, and I'm willing to put myself out there for it. And I know that there will probably be negative pushback, and I've seen some, although, you know, I've been able to engage with a certain kind of person who comes at this with at least, I mean, they have criticism, but the criticism has something behind it, and they're not just there to yell at me. I actually engage and have pretty good engagements around it and have learned a lot. And I'm actually really interested in talking to people who believe these things. And so I've been able to engage a few people online in ways that I think have been productive. If it doesn't look like it's going to be productive, I just block. I block them and try to get away from it.
Do you have any insights into the type of people who really go for these theories? I mean, are there any common threads or themes?
There's trajectories that pull people in. I talked to somebody and, you know, initially, I don't know if it was a woman or a man. I'll say it's a he, but I actually don't know that. I talked to him initially. It was GMOs. I was really anti-GMO. And then Alex Jones had this thing about GMOs. And then I learned about the Boston Marathon bombings being a false flag. And then I looked back and this other thing. And then the next thing this person knew, they're buying nutritional supplements off InfoWars. I never mentioned this in the blog, but there's all these, like, that's what they're selling on all these sites. I don't know what. So the sites that are doing it for money, they're doing it for ads and selling nutritional supplements for some reason I really can't figure out. But this person self-confessed, like, I'm buying this. I really believe in them. They've really changed my life. And it was the whole thing, like, bought hook, line, and sinker, this whole thing. But I don't, like, oh, you probably think I'm crazy. I said, I don't think you're mentally ill at all. I really think that these information trajectories can really draw us in. And possibly after getting inside of those, that you don't necessarily, I mean, reality starts to look blurry, which is that the quote I used in the blog, which I took from this article, the menace of unreality. But I think once you're in it, I think things can look confusing, and I think that can be disorienting. But I don't necessarily, I wouldn't go and say, like, these people are mentally ill, that's why they're in there. I don't think that's true. And I don't think they're not smart. I think they're actually, I think it appeals to smart people, if anything, more than other people, because, you know, smart people are the ones, they've been taught to go look at multiple sources. So they've been taught to do their own research. They've been taught to think for themselves. And these sites are selling, oh, you're thinking for yourself, you're doing your research, I'm going to give you the facts. And it can, they actually think that they're constructing their own ideology, when really it's being fed to them in ways that they can't perceive. So I don't think I can easily characterize them all, but I would say that our stereotypes are probably wrong.
Kate Starbird, it's been a pleasure speaking with you on the Security Ledger podcast.
All right, thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking about online conspiracies with Kate Starbird. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering at the University of Washington.